watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, we ended the program with John Taylor Gatto's account of the school riots in New York City in the early 1900s, when thousands of students and their parents protested the implementation of what was called the Gary Plan, that maximized the occupancy of school buildings by moving students from room to room and subject to subject in response to a series of bells. Like Pavlov's dog, stimulus followed by response, this is the system that now prevails all over America from middle school on. We heard how this was part of a plan pushed by corporate America to make schooling more practical, so-called, and less quote-unquote abstract, in other words, intellectual, and how this was accompanied by a media campaign. Making school more practical doesn't sound bad until one realizes that the goal was not to make school more useful for the students, but for businessmen. It was to begin the breaking of the spirit of young people so they could be reshaped to be obedient, conformist, and not too intelligent workers in industry. School, you see, was not conceived as being for the benefit of students. They were being prepared to benefit someone else. This situation has only worsened with the years as it has become normalized and ubiquitous and made people dumber and more helpless, less equipped to rule themselves and more willing to be ruled by others. The mid-20th century saw a rapid expansion of publicly funded post-secondary education that offered the possibility of making some measure of mental development accessible to all. This system, too, has been attacked and looted by corporate America, as we will hear this week. We're going to begin by following the fiscal and ideological assault on public higher education and hear how people are organizing and fighting back as one front in the battle for democracy against plutocracy.
This is a recording of Ben Mansky on Higher Education and the Democracy Movement, the Public University in an Age of Corporatization. He spoke at the Democracy and Education Conference at the Storrs campus of the University of Connecticut on April 2, 2006. The image of radical students dominating their campuses is obsolete if it was ever accurate. Over the last two generations, corporations have made new inroads into university life. Today, you are more likely to find a mega-chain bookstore or a so-called public-private partnership at a university than a chapter of SDS. But of course, change does not only move in one direction. Last spring, a group of students here at the University of Connecticut organized a Democracy in Education conference. The weekend was filled with speaker presentations, panel discussions, and even some musical performances. Among the speakers was Ben Mansky. Ben Mansky is a Wisconsin political activist, writer, and lawyer. He serves the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution and recently served as co-chair of the Green Party of the United States from 2001 through 2004. He was employed on the staffs of a number of environmental, social justice, pro-democracy, and education advocacy organizations throughout the 1990s, including Greenpeace, Progressive Dane, and the National Campus Greens. He has also worked with many other organizations, including the Independent Progressive Politics Network, United for Peace and Justice, and Earth First. He currently serves on the boards of the Press Connection Foundation and United Progressives for Democracy. He was introduced by student trustee Salman Kazarunian.
Higher education and the democracy movement, the public university in an age of corporatization. It's my pleasure to introduce Ben Mansky.
You can tell how tired Salman is because he referred to it as evening already. And I really got to say, the organizers of this conference have done a tremendous job, and I think they deserve a round of applause. And I want to tell you, I've been looking forward to talking with all of you because I'm very impressed with the organizing that I see going on here in Connecticut. And there's certainly things across the border in UMass that are stewing that are promising, too, on a national level. We'll be talking a little bit about that. I want to start off by taking a look back to ancient history for a lot of us, 1979. All right. And I want to do that to understand just how much higher education has changed in one generation in the United States, and specifically public universities and public education. In 1979, and all these figures are real dollars, right? These are today's dollars. Think of it as today's money. 1979, the average cost of tuition at a public institution for a year, $1,600. Okay, $1,600. 58% of those who entered community college or public university graduated within 4 years. 58%. 52% of federal financial aid came in the form of grants, and it was only at that time, 45% that were college loans that had to be repaid back. Sending somebody in your family to a public university or community college cost 6 to 13% of the average working class person's family income. 6 to 13%. More than 70% of the funding for public institutions came from public sources, not from tuition, not from corporations, but from the states, from municipalities, from the federal government, 70%. There was extensive federal investment and state investment, too, in renewable energy and sustainable agriculture, in investing in the economy of the future, an ecological economy. You also saw that students and the public were gaining more control over the universities, and that was really a product of the movements of the 1960s. But you saw the creation of shared governance structures, both in policy and in statute in some states, that gave students rights to participate in the governance of their institutions. And then finally, of course, campuses were seen as hotbeds of activism, or as I like to say, centers of civic participation. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, that sounds pretty good, right? You all agree that sounds like a vision for higher education? I'm seeing some heads nod. I want to hear some agreement. If you disagree, you can shout at me. All right, yeah. Well, for some people, higher education in 1979 was a disaster. It was terrible, and they had to change it. It was inefficient. It was ineffective. It was not serving the aims that they had for higher education and for the future economy in the United States. And so they began to use their political muscle and their money and their privileges to transform higher education in the United States. And this is what we started to see. First of all, in the 1980s, you started to see universities become more permeable, more accessible to corporate influence. And one of the major pieces of legislation, if you haven't heard of it, was signed by President Carter in 1980. Does anybody know what legislation I'm talking about? Bayh-Dole Act. All right, this is good. So there's your student trustee here. The Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, one of Carter's last acts as president, passed through, I believe, a Democratic Congress, too, right? What it did was it allowed public universities to use public funds to conduct research, which could become the proprietary interest of private corporations. In other words, corporations could sign contracts with universities and use public money, student tuition money as well, to produce research which was not publicly owned, but owned by Monsanto, owned by Exxon. Right? This opened the doors to the corporatization of research at public institutions. And it was really pivotal because after that, a lot of things started to change in terms of funding priorities at universities. So you saw the Bayh-Dole Act. You started to see lobbying that was effective to replace grants with loans that had to be repaid. You saw the push towards NAFTA and the creation of the World Trade Organization start to get going, right? I mean, Bush Sr., Papa Bush, wanted it. He didn't get it, but he made that agenda move. You saw major cuts in funding for public education. And then by the early 1990s, you saw corporatization really in overdrive. It just took off. And it took off in all sectors of society, but in higher education and in K-12 public education in particular. And there's a couple things that happened. You saw tuition start to skyrocket, just rise in a big way. Instead of 2 to 3% increases in tuition, now you started to see 8%, 10%, 11%. Right, and that's just increased more in the last several years. You saw the development of what they called public-private partnerships. And these were not really partnerships of any real kind. They were actually exploitive relationships in which a private corporation would take advantage of public resources, as was the case and is the case with university research. You saw the development of promotional contracts with private corporations. Coca-Cola, Reebok, Nike coming in. That's actually where I got some of my start in terms of campus organizing, was when Reebok came in and basically bought the rights to the Bucky Badger and the University of Wisconsin athletic department. And I'm proud to say that the University of Wisconsin no longer has an exclusive marketing agreement with any apparel corporation. So it took a long time. But that's, that was like a side effect of our organizing there. You saw the promotion of vouchers in K-12 education, sort of the privatization of K-12 of public education, and that certainly had an impact on students entering into public institutions. You saw the very well-funded attack on multiculturalism and political correctness. Right? It's interesting who talks about political correctness, not the left, but the right. Very well-funded attack, and what's not so well-known is where that money has come from, which I'm going to be talking about a little bit more in terms of funding that attack on multiculturalism, on political correctness, and also, most importantly, on affirmative action. You saw the creation of the World Trade Organization and the General Agreement on Trade and Services as a side agreement. How many people have heard of the GATS? Okay, good. So if you asked that question 10 years ago, no hands would have gone up, but that was when they were starting to talk about it. Essentially creating a global structure for imposing corporatization from above on public education, on health, on every aspect of public life. And so you saw that in the 1990s. You saw an attack on student fee autonomy that was a very well-funded campaigning that ended in the Southworth decision before the United States Supreme Court in 2004. The most was basically the end of that fight. How many people have heard of Southworth? Okay, so this is an important thing to inform yourselves about because it's very interesting. Those who oppose student power are much more familiar oftentimes with where our power comes from than we ourselves are, right? In the 1960s and the 1970s, student activists carved out some autonomy, some control over student fees, some role in shared governance, and in some places, it really had a profound effect on organizing. University of Wisconsin at Madison, the student association has a $20 million a year budget. $20 million. Okay. That's big time. It's a big school. So the right wing gets some money, and the Alliance Defense Fund out of Arizona finds some plaintiffs, and they sue the University of Wisconsin at Madison to say, you can't fund the Campus Women's Center, you can't fund the UW Greens, you can't fund the Black Student Union, because forcing students to pay student fees that can be used for the expressive activity of groups that they disagree with is a violation of their constitutional First Amendment rights. Okay. So that was their lawsuit. It was a very smart, well-funded, strategic attack on student power. And they almost succeeded. They almost succeeded. You saw that happen. You also started to see the remilitarization of the campus. I don't know. It would be interesting to do an audit. I don't know how many campuses you got sort of the campus police forces walking around with automatic rifles. But you sort of got to ask yourself, why are they rearming with AR-15s, you know, the same weapons that the United States illegally supplied the Contras with, right? So you started to see that in the 1990s, too. And we can see the results of corporatization today. So I gave you some statistics and an image of what higher education looked like in 1979. Let's look at it in 2000, 21 years later. Tuition more than doubled. Now, and by now, I'm talking 2000 here, it was almost $4,000 a year for tuition at most public institutions. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but remember, we're including community colleges and technical colleges here, too. And, of course, it's increased by about another $1,000 in the 6 years since 2000, right? We went from a 58% graduation rate to a 50% graduation rate. And you think about what kinds of communities and what kinds of students were most directly impacted. We talk a lot about recruitment and retention of students of color, but 70% of African-American students who don't complete graduation say that the cost of education was the number one reason why they couldn't finish, the cost of education. So, you know, making the campus a nice place to be is all good, you know, but driving down tuition, that's key. You know, anybody who gets to a public institution, they're fighting to be there. We got to make it more accessible. We went from 52% of college aid as grants to only 39%. So there's a reversal between grants and loans. And your generation of graduates is the most indebted generation of young people in American history. The average student who graduates from a public institution in the United States after 4 years for undergrad leaves with almost $20,000 in debt. $20,000, right? I just graduated from the University of Wisconsin Law School. And I left with the average debt for a law graduate, which is $80,000, right? You want to do public interest law and make $36,000 a year and pay off your loans over 30 years, right? I mean, there's all kinds of costs to the increases in tuition. There are all kinds of costs. There are costs to students. There's cost to young people. There's cost to society. We shifted from our investment in sustainable agriculture and renewable energy to investment in bioengineering, in biomedical research, in genetics. It's all corporate-driven research. The institutionalized student power and the shared governance that we'd gained in the 1970s, a lot of that has been lost. It's almost become token in a lot of places. So you'll have one or two students on the Board of Regents, and the process is not exactly transparent. And it's very rare that you'll have actual elections for those people. And when you take advantage of that, you know, that's a good thing. And while you saw some increase in college attendance for youth of color, and that's to be noted, those increases were almost entirely at 2- and 4-year community colleges and technical colleges, not at prestigious universities, where the attendance, the percentage of students that are students of color has actually gone down in many cases. And then finally, of course, campuses are still hotbeds of civic participation, which is why you're all here. And I want to address that. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, because I heard some questions earlier about, you know, how do we get people more involved and so on. But I think it's important to confront the myths about what the 1960s were like and what you're actually doing, because what you're doing is very important. Okay. And there are major victories which have happened in the last decade, which you should trumpet. All right. So that shift from 1979 to 2000, I hope it's clear that that wasn't the product of some invisible hand. That was the product of an agenda to promote corporatization of the university, the community colleges, the technical colleges, public education in general in this country. And just as people back then, the National Education Association put out a publication in 1984, could see what was coming, what was happening, had a really good analysis of it, so too can we look at what's happening right now and develop an analysis, an understanding of what's being done to public education in this country and develop a strategy for dealing with it and for stalling it and for reversing it. And I think part of that involves, first of all, identifying what they're trying to do now. You know, and it's important to recognize there's a lot of different actors out there that are pushing corporatization and for different reasons. But they do have certain common agendas. And here's a couple things that I almost guarantee nobody here in this room has heard of. How many folks have heard of charter universities? One hand. Two hands. Okay, good. All right. Essentially, this is a similar concept to the charter school, but it's been implemented in a couple schools. I guess maybe it's because I'm on the East Coast here, primarily in the East, where you give a little bit more autonomy, in fact, in some cases, a lot more autonomy to the crown campus of a public institution, say Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, or Cornell, or what have you. And you essentially continue the flow of public funds, but you loosen the public oversight. There's the introduction of the idea of vouchers for higher education. They've been pushing vouchers for K-12. Now they're pushing vouchers for higher ed, in Colorado in particular. So no longer will education be a right where we have a situation where there's sort of constant struggles over the cost of education and who's getting in, who's not, but they essentially want to marketize the public university. You see a return of the new McCarthyism, and you have David Horowitz traveling around the country talking about an academic Bill of Rights, which is intended to intimidate faculty and students and to create sort of the very opposite of what they're claiming to uphold. And I know that folks are familiar with that campaign, and I'm sure that Parenti probably talked about that yesterday, right? So you have that happening. You have continuing efforts to destroy student and labor power and also faculty power. You're going to see another push like Southworth going after student fee autonomy, shared governance, the role of students in the university. You see the fight to define graduate employees as not employees, as not workers, right? That the work that we perform is not work. You see attempts to do away with tenure, to make the faculty vulnerable so that they are at the mercy of the administration rather than the other way around. You also see the effects of corporate globalization, and actually that charter university model, I just came across this yesterday when I was prepping, that charter university model was actually borrowed from Sweden, believe it or not. But what you're seeing is that because we're part of a global education market, a global education economy, you're starting to see other countries emulate models that have failed here, and people here bring in models that have failed in Sweden. They call it the Foundation University, and there's only one Foundation University left in Sweden at this point in time. And then finally, you see a push to give the most important stakeholders more power in terms of the governance of higher ed. And by most important stakeholders, of course, I mean the business community, corporations. And you're seeing Kathy Lyle, David Ward, some of the main sort of liberal, in quotes, right, policy advocates for administrators saying, you know what, we have declining revenue for the public university and from the public sector, and we have to recognize that corporate funding is the way of the future. If we want corporations to fund our institutions, we have to give them more of a stake, more of a say. So we need to have not student seats on the Board of Regents for the Board of Trustees, but seats reserved for our partners in business. So that's their agenda. And I think we can see what the predictable result will be, right? Right? I mean, what's the future of higher education if we continue down this path? It's going to be less and less accessible. You're going to see management of the university become more and more corporate. We already think it's fairly hierarchical. Just you wait, right? You'll see an increasing priority on corporate, not public benefit, in terms of research, in terms of extension. You'll see overall, in terms of the effects on our society, that this society will become less and less democratic and will become more economically backwards, as well as backwards in other ways. So I think we can be all agreed that we've got to stop this train, the corporatization train.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, I know it's a Sunday afternoon. This is why I'm gonna be asking something of you, because there's the task that's at hand is a lot harder than sort of raising your voice in the choir here, right? It's some serious organizing that I know you're all engaged in. So in terms of the fight back, I think the first question to ask is, well, what works? And to look for what works, we can look a little bit around the United States, because there are some things that people are doing that are working. And we can look to the graduate employee union movement, which I think is still growing and very promising. But we can also look overseas, and we can look to our own history. And I think if you look overseas right now, some of the most exciting things going on around the world involve the strength of student unions. And I think that's this sort of one ingredient to this movement to democratize higher ed that I think is essential to those of us in the United States. Every other country in the world has a student union movement. Every other country. Go to Mexico, go to Canada, go to Ghana, South Africa, Taiwan, underground in Iran, right? The student union movement. Students organizing in their own interests for power. Not just benefits, but for power. And right now, in France, you see millions of students out on strike, because they understand their class interests, their interests as a generation, their interests as students. This past spring in Quebec, 300,000 students went on strike. 300,000. 80,000 marched in Montreal. How many people heard about that in the U.S. media? Right, in the U.S. media, okay. How many people heard about that in indie media and the progressive media? Now we see some hands going up, right? It's very significant stuff that student unions have been able to accomplish. South Africa, a national student strike underway for months. So we can look to what's going on in other countries right now and say, okay, well, what is it about that model that might be useful to us? Secondly, we can look to history. We can look to almost ancient history. Let's look to the first university. Does anybody know what the first university was? Not in the United States. I'm talking about
Sorbonne,
Northern Italy. Okay, Florence, Milan. Right. First universities were student unions. Okay. What happened was people traveled from all over Europe to get instruction from the faculty, and the faculty back then weren't as benign as they are now. And the faculty really exploited the students. The students arrived, and they had nowhere to live. They were basically at the mercy of the faculty. And so they organized unions, and they went on strike, and they brought the faculty to their knees, and they negotiated over tuition and living conditions. So that's what the first university was. Now, what happened to the university was that students gained all these new rights, and they wanted to preserve them, and so they traded them in for privileges. They went to their emperor, right, the Holy Roman Emperor, and they said, we have this problem called student transience, which is that students keep on graduating and leaving, and we can't preserve our student union, and we can't keep, you know, our power up so that we can negotiate with the faculty. So why don't you enshrine our rights, and please, Holy Roman Emperor, and preserve our rights for future generations? And essentially what happened was the student unions became incorporated. And that became the university that we have today. So we should recognize that there is a lot of history that has been lost to us should be valuable to us, because there's lessons to be learned. Like, don't go begging to the emperor to have your rights turned into privileges, right? We should look to the student union movement in the United States. People may be aware that there was a really vibrant student union movement in the United States from the 1930s through the early 1970s. And it's not by accident that in the late 1940s, the student movement in the United States was divorced from the international student movement. Something called the International Student Union today. It was actually co-founded by student activists in the 1940s from the United States. GIs coming back, they'd rubbed elbows with partisans in various countries and developed some thoughts about the world and about what future of higher education should be. And they formed this union, and what had ended up happening was that a more conservative group of students broke off. They formed something called the National Student Association of the United States. They were funded by the CIA. Most people didn't know that. Like, nobody knew that. But the CIA knew what they were doing. They're like, oh, this is a better development in the student movement. We have these more conservative students who are more interested in being part of student government and not in advocating and not in going on strike and not in being connected to all these Reds and all these other countries. And so the CIA got behind it and funded the National Student Association. And in 1963, it became known that the National Student Association had been bankrolled by the CIA, and they changed their name to the United States Student Association, which is the National Student Association of the United States, right? I'm not saying this as a dig against USSA today, but just we should know this history, right? So it's part of our history, too. And today, there are some positive developments. Students at the University of Missouri system are organizing a statewide student union. It's called Missouri Students United, and they're really organized. I mean, you can go to their website. There's a link to it on our website, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. There are folks at UC Santa Cruz who are organizing a student union, and they've started to develop partnerships with the student unions in Canada in particular to, you know, figure out, basically, to set up a mentoring relationship, to figure out how do they do it, how do they organize. Because they really got it all over us. So that's one model that I want to propose. The students need to organize like the labor movement organizes. We need to organize wall to wall. We need to sign up members. Secondly, we should look at campus-wide education unions too, not just student unions, but unions of students, faculty, staff, and members of the community. And this is something that a lot of people actually end up doing. A lot of you are doing this already, right? Because it's natural. But to do it because it's sort of the obvious thing to do to build these alliances is a little different than to do it in a conscientious way with determination to build an organization of all those constituencies that are not the bosses, not the administration, right? To fight for higher education, to fight for democratization of higher education, to fight for the right to access to higher education. And this can be done, and it's actually been done successfully recently in Mexico. The General Strike Committee de la Huelga, CGH, organized a very successful strike at the UNAM University, the largest university in the Americas, several years ago, in which faculty, students, staff went on strike, shut Mexico City down. And what was it over? It was actually over the imposition of tuition. The Mexican Constitution guarantees education is a basic human right. And when the government tried to impose tuition, they went on strike. So that model, I think, is something we need to look at, because I think it is, we have the capacity to start to do it. We have strong student organizations, we have faculty unions, we have graduate employee unions, you have the clerical and blue-collar staff organized, and you get these folks together and you have a lot of power. I think we need to look at our methods too, and I'll just focus on two things here. One is wall-to-wall organizing. I mentioned it earlier in terms of the model of student unions, and that's basically what student unions do. But what it means in practice is that when you go about your organizing, you break the campus down and you try to identify, you try to build relationships with every single person on that campus, essentially. You got to know who they are. If you can get a list of the entire student body, of all the faculty and staff, if you can start to methodically go through and make those contacts and figure out which side they're on and whether they'll be with you, to ask them to join you, if you can develop lists of all the classes on campus and make sure that you have a representative for whatever effort you're organizing, whether it's a hunger strike or a student strike or it's a campus-wide strike or whether it's a teach-in or a conference like this, identify every class, send somebody to every class to make an announcement. Where do they live? Go door to door in all the residences, canvas. That's wall-to-wall organizing. That's something that is just starting to be reintroduced to campus organizing now. But it's very effective when you do it. It's very time-consuming, but it's very effective when you do it. And when folks at UW-Madison did it during the Books Not Bomb strike several years ago, 5,000 students went on strike, okay? Because they talked to everybody. So we have more allies and more people who are open to us than we know, but we got to talk to them and we got to find them. And then, of course, I keep on talking about strikes. In terms of method, I think we also need to step it up in terms of direct action. We've got to recognize that sort of the old motto, direct action gets the goods, is not just a slogan. It's got some real meaning to it. In my experience, when I've looked at occupations of administration buildings, when I've looked at student strikes, people taking over state capitals, which all this stuff has happened all over the country in the last 5 or 6 years. I can cite numerous examples. They almost always win. It's pretty amazing. You almost always win. And you should sort of think about that. There's high costs involved in engaging in direct action. But there's also real gains to be won. A couple other things here. First of all, it's important to know your enemy, too, in terms of building this kind of resistance, this fight back. And I think it's important to understand that they have names and addresses. Again, there's no invisible hand, right? There's the Alliance Defense Fund, 15333 North Pima Road, Suite 165, Scottsdale, Arizona. Alliance Defense Fund funded the lawsuit against student fee autonomy in the 1990s. It also involved in all kinds of nasty, homophobic, and racist stuff, right, which motivated their lawsuit because they didn't like the LGBTCC and the Black Student Union and so on. So they got a name and they got a residence, and maybe people should, they got an office, maybe people should visit them sometime, right? With the Bradley Foundation, how many people have heard of the Bradley Foundation? Only one hand. Okay, so, and I see the Milwaukee in there knows about the Bradley Foundation. This is a nearly $1 billion endowment foundation now. That's sort of the opposite of Rockefeller in the sense that it was actually founded by a sort of liberal-minded businessman, you know, and then taken over by his right-wing descendants as opposed to a fascist businessman who's taken over by his liberal descendants, right? But this is a major foundation. Among other things that Bradley has funded over the years, from Charles Murray's bell curve, basically propagating the idea that blacks are genetically inferior to whites, to Asians, trying to cloak that idea in some kind of academic legitimacy. They paid for that to be published and for Charles Murray to go around the country spreading his bile. They paid for Ward Connerly, of the University of California Board of Regents to travel around the country attacking multiculturalism and affirmative action. Bradley funded the early studies that led to the corporatization of welfare in the United States. Milwaukee was the test ground for a corporatization of welfare and public education. It's no coincidence that Bradley is based there. They fund all kinds of bad things. They got an address. They also have a fence around their address. And quite a security system. 1241 North Franklin Place, Milwaukee. Very nice. White Lions in front. Always wanted to do a sit-in there. So if anybody wants to, if you want to host us there, we have a host in Milwaukee. National Association of Scholars, 221 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. Basically an association of right-wing faculty nationally who were very much at the forefront of the attack on affirmative action again. And they're funded by none other than Bradley. And then, of course, our old friends at the National Association of Manufacturers, who were at 1331 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. And you might not think of the National Association of Manufacturers and all their state affiliates and the Chambers of Commerce as being your enemy, right? But who do you think is up there in Congress and at the state legislature lobbying to cut funding to public education? Who is behind that? They're the main driving force in almost every state. They have an agenda. They're not just out there, you know, looking for more corporate welfare. They want less public welfare, too. You got to recognize that. And, of course, the boards of regents and trustees have names and faces and addresses, too. And while there's a couple good regents and trustees on almost any board, you can find them, it's important to recognize that they are identifiable and their holdings are identifiable. And one neat little thing that we did in the 1990s in Wisconsin was we said, you know, now that we finally figured out who these regents are, maybe it would be nice for the public to know, too. So we created Board of Regents trading cards. And their picture on every one. You could collect them all, 17. Had their holdings, where they live, how much money they gave to the governor before they were appointed. Almost all of them had maxed out at $10,000 apiece, right? And this has been emulated around the country, and I would strongly suggest that you do that. And for the one elected member of the Board of Regents in Wisconsin, we made sure we gave the good scoop on them. You know, sole elected regent, right? Actually listens to students and workers on the campus, which was definitely the case. So you might want to do that at UConn, and Solomon can sort of disown any knowledge of it. And we also need to globalize resistance. It's really important for folks in this country to develop relationships with the student union movements, with the campus movements in other countries, personal relationships that are lasting, because they do have a lot to offer, and it's also important to recognize that we are all in this together. Right? It is one global education industry, and that's becoming truer every day. So I hope that's helpful in terms of sort of giving you a sense of some of the things that are starting to happen, I think are really promising, and things that we need to do more of. I think our agenda is clear. It's not enough to just resist. We've got to democratize. We've got to change the institution. And I think all of us have that knowledge inside of ourselves, but there's one way that I like to sort of summarize it is by borrowing the phrase that's attributed to Lincoln. It was actually penned by Thomas Paine, of the people, by the people, for the people, right? What we're about is we're for education of the people. And what that means is that the people fund education, right? First of all, it's fully publicly financed, no private money. That means no money out of your pocket and no money from corporations. And that's the only way to ensure accountability and access. Secondly, we need to recognize that every university and every community college is chartered. Right? These are all corporations, and they are all chartered by state governments. And one thing we can fight for, we can make Yale a public university, right? One thing we can fight for is changes in the law that redefine education, change the corporate code, create a class of institutions that are educational corporations, and then write in all kinds of requirements for them. So if you want to set up a university, whether it's public or private, in a state, define that university from the get-go. It's got to be democratically managed. It's got to be free. It's got to be accessible. It's got to have an extension program, right? There's all kinds of things. We can take control at the front end. So we need education of the people. We need education by the people, the folks who have the stake, not business community, whatever that is, but the folks who are most directly invested need to have a role in terms of developing some kind of campus democracy, a real shared governance. So that means instead of having a student government association sort of token and becomes, you know, a breeding ground for lobbyists and, you know, members of the state legislature of the two major parties and so on, set up campus senates. This is how they do it in Canada and Mexico, right? Set up campus senates where the students elect students to the campus senate, faculty elect, staff elect, and that body makes the decisions, the key decisions, the important decisions. And let me tell you, when an election becomes about something important, people vote, and you have contested elections, and it really matters. Let's have fully elected boards of trustees and regents for those systems that are more than one campus. And let's also sort of reintroduce what is known in higher education policy circles internationally as the Wisconsin idea. And if it seems like I refer to Wisconsin a lot, it's partially because that's my most direct experience. But it's also because the University of Wisconsin system has been at the center of higher education policy and also organizing for the last 150 years. And there's something called the Wisconsin idea, which was that the boundaries of the university are the borders of the state. Right? There isn't this town-gown kind of relationship. The university is an engine for social change. That was the dream of the progressive movement in the early part of the last century. And that's something that I think we can bring to every university system. And then finally, we need to make sure that education is for the people. And that means, first of all, that it's got to be free. And you know what? It doesn't cost that much to make higher education free in terms of eliminating tuition in the United States would cost roughly $100 billion a year, less than $100 billion a year. Think about what we're spending on Iraq. Okay? What's that?
$20 billion a month.
$20 billion a month, so about a quarter trillion a year at that rate, right? This is definitely affordable. And if we were to return to the kind of progressive, the more progressive tax arrangements that we had in the 1950s, the golden era, right? So it's supposed to be the most conservative era in American history, but you know the corporate tax rate in most states was in the 30 percentile. Now it's down to the single digits. Let's restore progressive taxation to pay for it. And we also need to ensure that for education to be for the people, that we drive the public interest back into the heart of higher education. And just to give you an idea of how much we've lost, in 1925, the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents adopted the following policy. No gifts, donations, or subsidies shall in the future be accepted by or on behalf of the University of Wisconsin from any incorporated educational endowments or organizations of like character. No private outside funding coming into the university to drive the policies of the university. We need to return to that principle. We've had it before, and we can have it again. So why is this all important? You know, frankly, one of the problems that students in particular have is transience, as we know. They move on, and the institutional memory, the memory about how to organize gets lost. But another problem we have is that when we advocate on tuition, for example, or financial aid, or affirmative action, we're not actually directly advocating for ourselves in most cases. When 78 students went on a hunger strike last spring in the University of Wisconsin system against the tuition hikes, it's gone up 67% 4 years, by the way, 67%. When they did that, most of them were not coming back the following year. They were doing that for future generations. So our organizing really is about broader society in a lot of ways. I think we all recognize that education is not an island. It's not really an ivory tower, right? Everything we do has effects in broader society, for good and for ill. So first of all, we got to recognize that the process of corporatization of higher ed is very much tied to the corporatization of other key institutions, other key sectors of society. Right? The same folks, Bradley Foundation, right? National Association of Manufacturers, who advocated successfully for the corporatization of higher education and K-12, also are behind the corporatization of welfare, the increasing corporatization of the military. There are 25,000 men and women under arms in Iraq right now with the private military companies, the PMCs. Our military is being corporatized. Elections, we have corporations running our elections. Now there's a fight back against that that's increasingly successful. But these are key sectors of what government is supposed to do, right, that are being corporatized. We see it in water and in a lot of other sectors, and I want to suggest that people take a look. It's online. Look at the website here, at tni.org. This is the first time it's ever been published, a new yearbook on the state of public services internationally. It focuses on corporatization of public services internationally. And I was asked to write the chapter on corporatization in the United States. So we deal with a lot of different sectors of society. Disaster management, we've seen what's happened with the corporatization of disaster management in the Gulf Coast region. So what happens in higher ed is very much a part of what happens more broadly. And then, of course, there's a reason why we talk about the crisis of higher education. A crisis is, my understanding, is a combination of two terms, opportunity and danger, right? And the danger is that corporatization of higher ed cannot be reversed and redirected towards democratization without a broader democracy movement. Alone, folks on campus are not strong enough to win. So we need a movement for democracy in higher education that's part of a broader movement for democracy in society. And the opportunity is that a movement for democratization on campuses could actually be a fundamental building block. It could be vital to the development of a real democracy movement in the United States. Every other country in the world has a democracy movement. Capital D, capital M. We talk about the peace movement in the United States. We talk about the feminist movement, civil rights movement, black power movement. We talk about the environmental movement, labor movement. We don't talk about a democracy movement. That's because we don't got it yet. But the organizing you do in terms of higher education could be a fundamental part of that, linking up with movements to democratize elections, to democratize the workplace, to democratize local government, right? And I want to invite you to do that. And I'm going to end with this, and then we'll go to questions. I was actually reading last night a passage from one of the most radical Supreme Court justices in American history. This was shortly before most of us in this room were born. This is what he had to say. The universities should be completely freed from CIA and Pentagon control through grants of money or otherwise. Faculties and students should have the basic controls so the university will be a revolutionary force that helps shape the restructuring of society. A university should not be an adjunct of business, nor of the military, nor of government. Its curriculum should teach change, not the status quo. Then the dialogue between the people and the powers that be can start. And it may possibly keep us all from being victims of the corporate state. We must realize that today's establishment is the new George III. Whether it will continue to adhere to his tactics, we do not know. But if it does, the redress, honored in tradition, is also revolution, as William Douglas. So I want to ask all of you, gathered here at the University of Connecticut, to take up his charge to build a movement for the democracy, democratization of higher education, to build a democracy movement in this country, because future generations and so many billions of people around the world are depending on you to win. Thank you.
My question for you is about the corporate agenda for a response to a democratic movement for campuses. I don't know if you're aware, but in 1992, there was the Dear Hillary letter by the president of the National Education Association suggested legislation to substantially reform the nationwide college campuses so that they become less of an education program and more of a job, work type deal. If you look at the universities today, I think anybody who wants to... everybody knows there's something wrong who's paying attention. The complex literacy studies that just came out show that, you know, this is kind of like high school almost, if you look back to previous generations. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is starting up his Trump University, and he said schools do a lot of sitting around at the universities and a lot less doing. What about a corporate response, which would take out science students who tend to be decontextualized in their interests, engineers, a lot of profitable parts of the universities, and bring them into just completely corporate-run universities, and so that students, you know, now you don't even have to take English, and they attack the legitimate, they make a somewhat legitimate attack on the universities for failing and saying you need to be, you know, doing things like partaking in real work in society. Are there any current developments? And would you anticipate any responses on behalf of corporations to try to counter a democratic movement on the campus scene?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to recognize that they're the progressives in this case, right? They are moving the agenda. What they're progressing towards is anathema to most of us, but what you describe is already happening, as you said. And I'm glad you raised it, because when I said earlier that there was an agenda and I talked about they, and then I acknowledged that the they are different, there's different actors, it's important to recognize the Alliance Defense Fund is not like Catherine Lyle or David Ward, who are some of the main sort of liberal advocates or administrators nationally. They don't share the same values, right? You have liberals and Christian fundamentalists who have very different kinds of ideological outlooks. But what administrators around the country are responding to is the very process that you described, where they're saying, all right, look, if we don't make the public university more responsive to the needs of corporate America, the corporate sector, then we will continue to see public funding dry up, and we will see public universities become at a greater and greater disadvantage. And so they're making decisions already based on that. For example, John Dewey, right, wrote an excellent book, Education for Democracy. I believe that's the title of it. Founder of, I don't know, there's probably some education majors, not my field, but as my understanding, he's one of the most profound influences in education policy and thinking about pedagogy in this country. He founded the education school at University of Chicago. It's gone. Okay, education school, sociology department, social work, disappearing. All over the country within public universities in response to the kind of marketization effect that corporations are creating. So to me, what's our response? The question isn't so much what will their response be. I think you've identified what their agenda is very clearly. It's the question is what will our response be? And again, this is why it's so important that what happens in terms of work around education policy not just be framed around democratization, but that it be framed as part of a broader democracy movement. Because in the end, it's going to require public support, or public consensus around this alternative, democratic, I would argue more American vision for higher education. And also, it's going to require the public to use its inherent power, right? We're going to have to exercise the sovereignty of the people in order to counter corporatization. We're going to have to start going after charters. We're going to have to start rewriting the corporate codes. We're going to have to rewrite the law. We need to change the basic understanding of the right to an education in this country, right? We need to fight to enshrine the right to an education in our Constitution. These are fundamental questions. So that's why I think our response needs to involve the broader democracy movement.
I'm just wondering if you could speak to the war on drugs and drug offenders no longer having access to federal grant money. Mm-hmm. And how to organize against that, not exactly on a campus level, but for people who don't even have access to campuses now.
The question was about the war on drugs and the denial of federal aid money to students that have been convicted of drug possession, other drug offenses, right? And how do we effectively organize against that? What I'll say is, first of all, I bet there's somebody in this room who's involved with Students for Sensible Drug Policies. Anybody? Okay. Well, check them out then, because they're doing some very effective work actually in the Dakotas right now. I believe in North Dakota there's a major campaign that's brewing to sort of reverse the policy of excluding students who've had those convictions. Of course, it's a racist policy in practice in terms of who, first of all, who gets caught and who gets off, right? But it's also got to be part and parcel of the broader agenda, too. And I think it's always important. I mean, there's a lot of sort of different aspects and there's different fights, but there's got to be a broader agenda for higher education as well. And I'm realizing that I actually had intended to address that and I forgot to. So I'll use this opportunity to talk about some practicalities, which is, first of all, I work for a nonprofit which is called Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution. And our goal is to help nurture a democracy movement in the United States. That's, you know, we have a capital D, capital M democracy movement that people are talking about. It's living and breathing way bigger than us. Then we'll know we succeeded, right? And one of our program areas is democratizing education. And as part of that work, we've been taking some of the steps that I've talked about. Last spring, we organized a retreat in Ottawa with folks from six public universities in the United States who went up to Ottawa and met with the student unions from Canada and Quebec to learn from them. We're building networks of faculty, of staff, of undergrads and grads, community members who are concerned about higher education. I want to invite everybody here to participate in that. But one thing that has come out of that work already is that there was a convention at the University of Wisconsin last fall that involved people from 9 states and 2 provinces and 30 campuses who attended, and they came up with a democratizing education charter, basically a bill of rights for higher education. And I think that it's just important for us to start to spread that charter around, to maybe put it on the ballot. Students could adopt it, right? Let's build some buy-in to it and organize around sort of a common agenda while we're also doing our single issue work.
I have a question. If you could talk a little bit about teachers, especially adjunct teachers. I believe at least 40-50% of major public universities are the teachers are adjuncts who are making poverty level wages, and if you could talk about that a little bit, the history about that, if that's how new that is, and if there's cases you know of adjunct faculty fighting back and organizing.
Certainly, my mom's one of them. She's University of Illinois Chicago adjunct, and they've unionized. And my understanding is that there's been a major shift, as you said, towards the dependence on adjunct and also on graduate employees for teaching. And again, this is just another effect of the sort of the deeper problem, which is the increasing reliance of the university on corporate money, the decrease in public financing. And so, yeah, I mean, what are the responses? I mean, the responses I think you identified to some extent. Get organized, form unions, build alliances with students and with the community. And again, I think we really do need to start focusing on some of the key issues, the key problems that drive almost all of our problems, which have to do with power and money. You know, those are the two. You really want to boil down sort of everything that's happening in higher education has to do with power and money. Who makes the decisions? Where does the money come from? And where the money comes from drives where the money goes. So, you know, I think, you know, frankly, that's one of the reasons why you see the attack on faculty tenure. That's part of this Bradley Foundation-funded attack on public higher education in general, is that they want to see public universities become more vulnerable to competition from the private sector. They, you know, in 1979, they looked at public higher education and they saw it as inefficient because it was all subsidized. And for folks who don't know, I'll just make another plug for this. One of the things that the Democratizing Education Network and Liberty Tree are supporting is the 10th State University movement, which has started to take off nationally. And this is the development of popular universities on campuses. It started at Rutgers, and last year, Santa Cruz, Texas, University of Missouri, Kansas City picked it up. Now it's spread to Wisconsin, Michigan. I know UMass Amherst is doing it. And this is it's an interesting model. Right, it's sort of like it's like an outdoor teaching, basically. You can do it as a teaching too if you want, but basically, folks taking control of their university for a week or 2 weeks by having, you know, classes and organizing direct actions and so on. And it's something that you can find out more about by going to tentstate.org. And I urge you to look at that. And the reason why Michi sort of triggered my mind about that is they're going to be shutting campus down. They're going on strike later this month at UMass Amherst, so definitely make those connections. Got a hand back there.
Yeah, I was wondering if you can make some comments about sports. Here we're obviously a big basketball school, and it seems to me that if the university were to become more democratic, you know, because those funds are handled separately, and because, frankly, a lot of people wouldn't want you taking funds away from the basketball team, but I mean, here alone, I think in the last year, the Wall Street Journal said we spent almost twice as much in the last year on just basketball, and obviously there's corporate ties and merchandise and everything else, but how do you recommend that we approach that? Because, you know, if you go to somebody, you know, screw that, they want the team to win. And on top of that, you know, would even democratizing, you know, the main body of the university really do very much?
That's a good series of questions. I mean, my personal involvement in terms of organizing around athletics was limited to the Reebok fight. And that was interesting because we were able to take a populist approach to our organizing. And the name of the campaign at that time was called the Free Bucky Campaign. We got Bucky Badger, right? So we were in the homecoming parades, and we had Bucky Badger in chains and the Reebok police, you know. And basically, it was all about liberating Bucky Badger from the Reebok Corporation.